inheritance. And he gave one of the most fantastic homilies at his dad's funeral. Hello,
excuse me,
Mike. How are you? Nice to see you. Just about to compliment you on your funeral homily.
I was trying to sneak
dad's
in without
man,
being noticed.
How you doing?
But you ruined it.
Mike's father was a transistorized version of him. I forget what the occasion was, but you were complaining about people screaming and yelling about something, and your father said, "Let them holler, it's good for their lungs."
Yes.
Anyway, welcome. It has been now 5 years since the remarkable events that unfolded between February and April 2005, and yet my mind and imagination, and I suspect many of yours as well, goes back time and again to the last illness and death of John Paul II. It was an extraordinary human drama, perhaps one of the few genuinely global dramas in history. An entire world gathered metaphorically around the bed in the papal apartment to help John Paul II through what he called his Passover. Let me suggest, however, that we ought to reflect on February, March, and the first half of April 2005, not just as extraordinary human drama, but as extraordinary Christian drama, and indeed as an extraordinary priestly drama. For what the world saw, whether it recognized it in these terms or not, and what the Church lived through, whether and hopefully recognized as such, was manifestly the death of a priest. For the last time, Karol Wojtyła led the Church and the world into an experience of the mystery of Jesus Christ crucified and risen. And that is the vocation of priests, to lead the Church and the world into an experience of the mystery of Jesus Christ crucified and risen. How did he do that? As I turn back in my own mind's eye to those remarkable 3 months, certain moments etched in poignancy come to mind. I remember the Pope returning to the Vatican from the Policlinico Gemelli on February 10th and then again on March 13th, with throngs of Romans crowding the streets to welcome back the man they had once thought of as lo straniero, the stranger, but whom they now thought of quite literally as il Papa, father. I think of the Pope with a palm branch in his hand at the window of the Apostolic Palace on Palm Sunday. I remember the Pope in his chapel in the papal apartment on Good Friday evening, holding fast to a crucifix while watching the Via Crucis at the Roman Colosseum on television. You probably remember that on that occasion the Pope was backshot, the television camera behind him, so that all you saw were his back and his hands holding that crucifix. Why, I was asked frequently on NBC in the next days. It was not, I replied, in order to hide his tracheotomy and his suffering, but rather to underscore the message taken around the world by this most visible of men in history, who had been seen live by more human beings than anyone else ever. And that message was, don't look at me, look at Jesus Christ. Then I see in my memory the Pope at the window of his apartment on Easter Sunday, the window from which he had led the Sunday Angelus of Regina Caeli for more than a quarter century, unable to speak but blessing the city and the world over and over again as if for the last time. And then I remember, of course, John Paul II on Friday and Saturday, April 1st and April 2nd, concelebrating Mass from his deathbed, excuse me, making the Stations of the Cross Friday afternoon, as he had done every Friday of his life since he was a teenager, and struggling to articulate a last message to the thousands of young people gathered outside his window in St. Peter's Square, a message his associates finally understood as, "I have sought you out, now you have come to me, I thank you." And finally, I remember the last words of the dying Pope on the afternoon of April 2nd, asking in his native Polish, be taken to the Father's house. The extraordinary dignity with which John Paul II bore his final illness and his long suffering was the last great paternal and priestly lesson he taught the Church and the world. As news of his death cascaded around the globe, tens of millions of people, perhaps even hundreds of millions of people, suddenly felt a little orphaned. In a world bereft of paternity and its unique combination of strength and mercy, Karol Wojtyła had become a father to countless men and women. As Time magazine's Nancy Gibbs wrote movingly about the feelings of those in St. Peter's Square, looking at that window with the small lit candle while the Pope was dying, "You feel smaller when your father dies, because he was strong and lifted you, carried you and taught you, and when he's gone, the room feels too big without him." So it was in St. Peter's Square, where pilgrims kept vigil, their faces traced in low light by candles murmuring, "Don't leave us." Among the believers, there was almost disbelief that death still comes, even to a man this strong. The Holy Father, who had carried people so far, lifted them so high, taught them so much. When a pope is buried, a legal document called the Rogito, which summarizes his life and accomplishments, is buried with him. Sealed in a metal tube and placed inside the Cyprus coffin of John Paul II on the morning of April 8, 2005, the Rogito for the late Pope ended in these fitting terms: "John Paul II has left to all an admirable testament of piety, of a holy life, and of universal fatherhood." Let me suggest tonight, however, that this universal fatherhood was not generic, but rather quite specific. It was a distinctively priestly form of paternity, a form of paternity based on Christian fearlessness. "Be not afraid," that familiar antiphon of the pontificate, first ringing out at his installation on October 22, 1978, is a paternal admonition, an expression of priestly encouragement. John Paul II lived a form of paternity that took its strength from Jesus Christ, priest and victim. Jesus Christ, who carried all the world's fear to the cross, and by immolating that fear in the perfect sacrifice of the Son to the will of the Father, enabled all who are incorporated into him to live not without fear, but beyond fear. For 26 and a half years, that proclamation of Christian fearlessness and the summons to renew cultures, societies, political communities, and economies on the basis of Christian humanism was John Paul II's program, as we discussed this afternoon. Its focal point was the Great Jubilee of 2000. For John Paul, the Jubilee was not to be understood as a kind of global birthday party for Jesus, although deepening the Church's understanding of the mystery of the Incarnation was surely at the center of the Jubilee celebration. Rather, the strategic purpose of the Great Jubilee of 2000, as we looked at this afternoon, was to launch the Church into the deep of a new evangelization, as the Pope put it in Novo Millennio Ineunte, his apostolic letter closing the Great Jubilee, which gives Father Landry his computer password, Duke and Alpha. That was not Duke and Butler, but Duke and Elton. If the Church stayed in the shallows, minding the institutional shop, he thought, it wouldn't be much or do much. More grievously, it would fail its Lord. But having reminded itself on the 2000th anniversary of the Incarnation that all things are indeed possible with God, the Church had to get out of the shallows and put out into the deep of the modern world and the postmodern world and whatever other worlds humanity found itself in. Why? Not so much to argue as to propose. The Church proposes, the Church imposes nothing, John Paul had written in the encyclical Redemptoris Toris Missio. And to propose what? As the Pope said on so many occasions, propose Jesus Christ as the answer to the question that is every human life. That was the proposal John Paul was convinced the world was waiting for out there in the deep of individual lives, as well as cultures and societies. And that is the proposal the church's priests have to make in order to inspire a renewed evangelical energy in the people of the church, empowered by that priestly ministry of yours to take the Christian proposal out into the deep of contemporary society. What were the sources of this priestly paternity, this distinctively priestly form of fatherhood in John Paul II? The first inspiration, I think, came from his own father. There has been a lot of rubbish written about John Paul II and his mother, who died when he was a very young boy, and you can find all sorts of psychobabble about the Pope's Marian piety as displaced maternal affection, and so forth and so on. Fact of the matter is that Karol Wojtyła didn't remember his mother terribly well. It was his father, Karol Wojtyła Sr., who was the defining figure in his life as a boy, as an adolescent, and as a young man. A quiet man with no formal education beyond elementary school, a retired military officer, a man of granite-like integrity, he was also, as his son later wrote, a man of constant prayer who taught his son by example that the church is more than a visible institution of which one is a member. For as John Paul II put it in Gift and Mystery, his vocational memoir, Karol Wojtyła Sr.'s ascetic and spiritual life taught the future pope that the mystery of the church, its invisible dimension, extends beyond the structure or organization of the church. Structures, John Paul II would later put it, are at the service of the mystery. So it was with Karol Wojtyła Sr., the man everyone in the town of Wadowice called the captain, who first planted in the future pope the idea that the life of faith first has to do with interior conversion, with letting the mystery enter into and begin to form one's own life. Perhaps just as importantly, Karol Wojtyła Sr. taught his son that prayerfulness and manliness are not antinomies. To be manly, in fact, was to be able to go down on one's knees in front of the mystery. To be manly was to be able to acknowledge one's utter dependence upon the grace of God in one's life. As the son would later write of the father, his example was in a way my first seminary, a kind of domestic seminary. For a man in love with the gift of his priesthood when he wrote those lines 50 years after his ordination, no finer filial tribute to a father could be imagined. The second inspiring source of a distinctly priestly form of paternity in John Paul II was the Prince Archbishop of Krakow, Adam Stefan Sapieha, the man who would ordain him a priest. Until September 1, 1939, Archbishop Sapieha, who came from a noble Lithuanian family, hence the title Prince Archbishop, was, if I can put it this way, a rather conventional ecclesiastical careerist. He had been one of the private secretaries of Pius X. The simple gold pectoral cross that John Paul II wore was a duplicate of the pectoral cross that Pius X had given Sapieha when consecrating him a bishop in the Sistine Chapel in 1911. A year later, in 1912, Sapieha was sent back to Krakow, then still a part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, as archbishop, where he might have expected to feel the red hat descend, and sooner rather than later. However, he had an unfortunate run-in in 1920 or thereabouts with the new apostolic nuncio to independent Poland, who had been named a bishop but had not yet been consecrated, a former librarian named Achille Ratti. when Rafi came to the annual meeting of the Polish bishops at the monastery of the Black Madonna in Częstochowa and tried to enter, Sapieha barred him at the door, saying, "This meeting is for bishops only." It was not, as the personnel managers would say, a good career move, because 2 years later, Nuncio Ratti was elected Pius the 11th, and while he may have forgiven, he did not forget. So, Sapieha labored on in relative obscurity, absent the red hat that had marked his predecessors for centuries, until September 1st, 1939. Then, in the wake of the Nazi invasion of Poland, and at the age of 72, this hitherto timid and rather conventional ecclesiastical bureaucrat became the visible symbol of Poland's determination not to be crushed under the Nazi jackboot. Or, to return to our theme, Archbishop Sapieha developed an extraordinary capacity for fatherhood in service to a hard-pressed people. For 4.5 years after the Germans closed the Krakow Seminary in 1939, Sapieha, at the risk of his own life and his seminarians, ran a clandestine seminary out of his residence. Students came in and out of the residence in the early morning or in the dark of night for spiritual direction, academic instruction, serve the Archbishop's Mass, and so forth. Then, in early August 1944, when the Gestapo tried to arrest all the young men of Krakow in order to forestall a repetition of the Warsaw Uprising, Sapieha brought his seminarians in from the cold. He hid them in his house. His living room and dining room were transformed into a dormitory, and his drawing rooms into classrooms. And there, in the Archbishop's house, he and they lived an underground seminary experience for the next 6 months. Every night at 9 p.m., several dozen young men, including Karol Wojtyła, watched Adam Stefan Sapieha go into the chapel in his residence, where he laid the grave problems of the day before the Lord in prayer. From Sapieha, who embodied the ancient Cracovian tradition that the bishop is the finer defensor civitatis, the defender of the city, its people, and their rights, Karol Wojtyła absorbed a heroic concept of the priesthood. Those essential hours of prayer before the Blessed Sacrament led to an active public ministry in which the priest, following the example of Christ the High Priest, offers his life for the service of his people. When he finally got his red hat in Pius XII's first consistory in 1946, Cardinal Sapieha's train was met on his return to Krakow from Rome by a huge crowd of well-wishers, and the students present simply picked up the Archbishop's car and carried it and the Cardinal from the train station to Sapieha's residence. It was testimony to the reverence in which this old man was held, a reverence which you can still experience today. Because just across the street from the Archbishop's residence in Krakow is the Franciscan Basilica. And on its lawn, you can find an extraordinary contemporary sculpture of Sapieha, commissioned by Cardinal Karol Wojtyła in the 1970s. A man in a plain cassock, staring down as if looking into the very jaws of hell itself. And the inscription in Polish reads, "Adam Stefan Sapieha, Archbishop of the Long Dark Night of Occupation." That man, bearing that history, ordained Karol Wojtyła a priest on All Saints Day, 1946. John Paul II would later write in Gift and Mystery about the meaning of that experience of ordination for his understanding of the priesthood. Quote, "The one about to receive holy orders prostrates himself completely and rests his forehead on the church floor, indicating in this way his complete willingness to undertake the ministry being entrusted to him. That rite has deeply marked my priestly life, years later in St. Peter's Basilica at the very beginning of the Second Vatican Council, I was thinking back on that moment of ordination to priesthood, and I wrote a poem. I would like to share a few lines of that poem here. Peter, you are the floor that others may walk over you, knowing where they go, you guide their steps. You want to serve their feet that pass as rock serves the hooves of sheep. The rock is a gigantic temple floor, the cross a pasture. When I wrote those words, John Paul continued, I was thinking of Peter and of the whole reality of the ministerial priesthood and trying to bring out the profound significance of this liturgical prostration. In lying prostrate on the floor in the form of a cross before one's ordination, in accepting in one's own life, like Peter, the cross of Christ, and becoming with the apostle a floor for our brothers and sisters, one finds the ultimate meaning of all priestly spirituality. John Paul II, Karol Wojtyła, had many mentors in the spiritual life. Jan Tarnowski, the lay mystic who during World War II introduced him to the classics of Carmelite spirituality, especially the works of John of the Cross. Columba Marmion, whom he later beatified. Thank you. St. John Vianney, in light of whose example he vowed to become a prisoner of the confessional. But if we're looking for the sources of Wojtyła's experience of the priesthood as a form of paternity, we might also, beyond his father and Cardinal Sapieha, look to the network of lay friends he first met when they were university students in Krakow, and he was their chaplain, men and women who remained among his closest friends up until the end of his life. If you asked the popes of the last 200 or 300 years to describe their critical early years in the priesthood, any pope in question would have talked about teaching in a seminary or being posted abroad in the diplomatic service of the Holy See. If you ask John Paul II what was most important in those critical early years of his priesthood, he gave a very different kind of answer. He talked about working with college kids and about the lasting influence his experience as a university chaplain had on his concept and exercise of the priesthood. And he talked quite openly about the importance of those young lives in helping form him into the kind of priest he became. Indeed, as he told me one night over dinner, as I was just beginning to work on what became Witness to Hope, you must talk to my środowisko, is the Polish word, milieu or environment, that was their title for this group of young lay friends. You can't understand me, he said, without understanding me in relationship to them. It's also interesting to note that this most priestly of priests, Karol Wojtyła, was the first pope in centuries who had originally intended to live his Christian vocation as a layman. Most of the other popes of recent centuries put on their first cassock at age 11 or 12, disappeared into an Italian seminary, and emerged at age 22 ordained. This pope was different. This was a man who, until he was a young adult, intended to live his Christian vocation in the world as a layman. And even as he was wrestling with the idea that he had been chosen for the priesthood, he intuitively understood what Vatican II would call, some 20 years later, the universal call to holiness. He knew that sanctity was not limited to the sanctuary. And so when, as a priest, he began forming young men and women into mature Christian disciples, he could see in this form of spiritual paternity the paternity he may have imagined for himself in another context prior to his understanding that he had been chosen for the Church's ordained ministry. With these young men and women, many of whom went on to distinguished professional and academic careers, and one of whom I just exchanged an email with 10 minutes ago, Father Karol Wojtyła was a challenging and demanding friend. but his challenge was always characterized by what one woman who knew him well for 50 years called his permanent openness. Whereas another lay member of this remarkable circle of friendship put it, Wojtyła had mastered the art of listening. And that capacity for listening was complemented by a deep respect for the freedom of others. One of Karol Wojtyła's old kayaking and hiking companions, a scientist, once told me, I talked to him for hours and hours, but I never heard him say, I'd advise you to fill in the blank. He'd throw light on a problem, but then he'd always say, you must decide. Gently compelling decisions, gently bringing young lives into an encounter with their own capacity for spiritual and moral growth, that was the hallmark of Father Karol Wojtyła's priestly form of spiritual paternity. In this dialectic of intimacy and reserve, challenge and respect for freedom, which was characterized by a complete lack of clericalism and a deep mutual respect, Karol Wojtyła developed the pastoral strategy he would later call accompaniment. As he understood it, accompaniment was an attempt to get beyond the pattern of sporadic encounters between priests and young people, a pattern that frequently resulted in the priest being suspected of prying into the crevasses of conscience. Accompaniment, rather, was a way of walking with young adults, of helping them unveil their humanity by living through their problems with them. As a colleague would later describe the process, Father Wojtyła tried to accompany someone else in their problems, not simply as a safe shoulder on which to cry, but so as to help unveil the humanity of the other at a new depth. In Wojtyła's view, this was the way a priest lived out his vocation to be alter Christus, another Christ. The strategy of accompaniment was also another expression of Wojtyła's commitment to the spirituality of the cross, which he had begun to learn from those Carmelite mystics during the Second World War. Why? Because God himself had accompanied human beings into the most extreme situation resulting from bad human choices, death, through his own divine choice to be Redeemer as well as Creator. This is what happened on the cross. In Karol Wojtyła's view, the cross of Christ was the final justification for a pastoral strategy of accompaniment. In his work as a university chaplain in Krakow, we also see the beginnings of that extraordinary magnetism for young people that was such a dramatic element in John Paul II's exercise of the office of Peter. Times beyond counting over the last 20 years, I have been asked how I account for John Paul II, Pied Piper of the Young. The conventional answer to this, of course, is that this was a form of that celebrity craziness to which young people are often susceptible. But that answer, which never made much sense, made absolutely no sense as John Paul II became old and crippled. And it didn't make sense because the Pope was asking things of young people that no celebrity would dream of asking. My constant answer to the question why the magnetism has been twofold. First, there was the transparent integrity of John Paul II. Young people, particularly young people discerning what to do with their lives, have extremely acute baloney detectors. I use the polite noun. They can smell falseness several miles off. And there was not a whiff of that in John Paul II. Here, transparently, was a man who lived what he proposed. He did not ask young people anything he hadn't required of himself. He was not asking them to take on any burden he had not borne. He was simply asking them to let him and to let the church accompany them in bearing those burdens and in taking on the task of conforming their young lives to Christ. Transparent integrity was the first quality that young people found extraordinarily compelling about John Paul II. The second element of his magnetism, I think, was precisely his challenge. John Paul II did not pander to young people. Contemporary culture, on the other hand, constantly panders to the young in advertising, in its accommodation of patterns of dress, in dumbing down academic requirements, in lowering behavioral expectations. Young people today grow up surrounded by a world that tells them that they're wonderful, that there's no real effort required to be all that you can be, that if it itches, scratch it. It's all pander all the time. Then comes this old guy, this Polish priest, this bishop, this pope who doesn't pander, and who in a infinity of variations on the same great theme lays down this challenge. Never, ever settle for less than the spiritual and moral greatness with which, by God's grace, you are capable. Don't ever settle for anything less than that. You will fail, but that is no reason to lower the bar of expectation. Get up, dust yourself off, seek forgiveness and reconciliation, and go forward or attune to the grace of God in your life. But don't ever lower the bar. Never settle for anything less than the spiritual and moral grandeur that is nascent in you and that the cross of Christ makes available to you through the grace of the Holy Spirit. That challenge struck home. In an age that is skeptical, even cynical, about the heroic, John Paul II knew from his own pastoral experience that young people want to be summoned to lead lives of heroism, even to lead lives of heroic sacrifice. John Paul's papal thinking on spiritual paternity was at its richest, I think, in the 1980 encyclical on God the Father, Dives in Misericordia. By the time he came to write Rich in Mercy, John Paul had been thinking about fatherhood for a long time. Life with his own father and with the unbroken prince, Cardinal Sapieha, had given him a profound experience of both familial and spiritual paternity. He had come to think of his own priesthood as a form of paternity. And as his intuitions about fatherhood deepened, he had made a dramatic claim in a poetic essay called Reflections on Fatherhood. There, Wojtyła wrote in the late 1960s, "Everything else will turn out to be unimportant and inessential except for this. Father, child, love." And then looking at the simplest of things, all of us will say, could we not have learned this long ago? Has this not always been embedded in the bottom of everything that is? Fatherhood is at the bottom of everything that is. Not electrons, protons, neutrons, and all the other apparatus of the atom. As John Paul developed that intuition in Dives in Misericordia, he opened up for us new dimensions of familiar biblical texts. Themes from the Hebrew Bible enriched John Paul's reflections in Dives in Misericordia on Jesus' preaching of the gospel of mercy and illustrated the late Pope's conviction that Christianity could only be understood through Judaism and its unique role in salvation history. Thus, John Paul II wrote that while God's merciful love begins in the very mystery of creation, it was the experience of the people of Israel which revealed that, quote, mercy signified a special power of love, a love strong enough to prevail over sin and infidelity. And while the Old Testament constantly teaches that God is a God of justice, it also reveals that love is greater than justice. Greater, the Pope wrote, in the sense that it is primary and fundamental. For Christians, of course, that Old Testament teaching is completed in the mystery of Christ's passion, death, and resurrection, which is the revelatory icon of the Father's mercy. For here, mercy is shown to be stronger not only than sin, but stronger than death itself. For Carol Wojtyła, the parable of the prodigal son was a synthesis of this biblical theology of mercy. In John Paul's exegesis, the prodigal son is a kind of human everyman, burdened by the tragedy of the human condition, which the Pope described as the awareness of squandered sonship, the awareness of having lost one's human dignity. The forgiving father, by being faithful to his paternity and going beyond the strict norm of justice, restores the wayward prodigal son to the truth about himself, which is the truth of the lost dignity of his sonship. True mercy does not weaken or humiliate its recipient. It confirms the recipient in his or her human dignity. Thus, the priest, in the exercise of the Church's mercy, which is the mercy of Christ, is both Alter Christus and Defensor Hominis, the defender of the dignity of the human person. John Paul's theology of the priesthood was also displayed in the 1992 apostolic exhortation, Pastores Dabo Vobis, where the Pope underscored several key points. First, he lifted up the distinctive vocation of the ordained priesthood, precisely so that the ordained priesthood would ennoble and empower the priestly character of all the baptized. Secondly, he showed that the ground of the distinctiveness of the ordained ministry is biblical and theological, not sociological. When Jesus tells his fellow townsmen in the Nazareth synagogue that Isaiah's messianic prophecy is being fulfilled in their midst because he has been consecrated by an anointing of the Holy Spirit, he was describing, the Pope wrote, the essence of a new kind of priesthood, a priesthood of perfect mediation between God and humanity. This was something new in salvation history, and according to John Paul II, it is, quote, absolutely necessary for understanding the nature of the Church's ordained ministry, which is a unique participation in this unique priesthood of Christ. Pastores Dabo Vobis emphasized that to be a priest is not simply to perform a task or play a role, but to become an Alter Christus, a personal continuation of the mediating priesthood of Jesus himself. Ordination, John Paul reminded the Church and the world, does not simply authorize a man to conduct certain types of ecclesiastical business. Rather, priestly ordination configures a man to Christ in a unique way, and that configuration confers a solemn obligation to serve the Christian community. Service, in other words, is the way the priest's unique sacramental authority becomes an image of Christ the High Priest. The image of Christ the Good Shepherd reveals the specific form of holiness that, in John Paul's view, must inform the priesthood, what he called in Pastores Dabo Vobis the holiness of pastoral charity. The priest's headship of a local Christian community is a form of headship or spiritual paternity that is not defined by power. Christian headship consists in being a servant, in being a priest suffused with pastoral charity, in being one who, as the late Pope put it, makes a total gift of self to the Church, following the example of Christ. In all of this, John Paul II understood that we are dealing with a gift and a mystery. Reflecting on the mystery of the priesthood as understood by John Paul the Great, however, I'm often reminded of something Archbishop Ed O'Brien, currently of Baltimore, once said to me. A man will give his life for a mystery, but not for a question mark. If we're looking for the reasons why John Paul II was, as Cardinal William Baum once put it, the greatest vocations director in the history of the Church, I think the answer is here. John Paul was the greatest of vocations directors because he had entered into the mystery and let it transform it. Rather than draining the priesthood of its mystery, he let himself be led ever more deeply into the mystery of priestly self-sacrifice, as we saw in those last 9 weeks of his life, during which he allowed himself to be led ever more deeply into the mystery of the priest as victim who lays down his life day in and day out for his people. How could he do this? He could do it for the same reason I described late this afternoon, that he could change the world. He could do it because he was a radically convinced Christian disciple whose discipleship was the foundation of his priesthood. And his living his priesthood as a form of spiritual paternity was rooted in that discipleship. So if there is one great lesson, one great truth to be learned from the 58 years, 5 months, and 1 day of the luminous and world-transforming priestly ministry that Karol Wojtyła, Pope John Paul II, gave to the Church, it is this. A true priestly vocation begins with a commitment to radical discipleship. A true priestly vocation begins with, is nurtured, and lives from a man's commitment to the truth that Jesus Christ is the answer to the question that is every human life. Last time I was with Pope John Paul II was on the evening of December 15th, 2004. We had formed this habit of having dinner 10 days, 2 weeks before Christmas. I had brought him, it was actually quite fun. You never was sure in those days what kind of shape he was going to be in. But he was in very good form, and he had this odd tick of, seems odd to me at any rate, he liked big photo books, you know, coffee table photo books. I think it got his poet's imagination. So I had schlepped over to Rome this enormous book of national parks of the United States, which I gave him at the dinner table. And he was a guy who believed in opening his Christmas presents when he got there. He was waiting. So he opens the thing, and he's sort of looking through it, and he sees Rocky Mountain National Park. And he opens it to that. And he says, Rocky Mountain National Park, Denver, World Youth Day, 1993. Bishops of America said it couldn't be done. I proved them wrong. I had brought him, in addition to that, a card signed by everybody in my family. And he took a pen, he asked for a pen, and he laboriously wrote out, Happy Christmas, God bless you, and John Paul II, and gave it to me to take back to everybody. It took about 2.5 minutes just for him to write that, but, you know, by God, he was going to get it done. And, you know, that was the night I told him, I mean, at that point, who knew what was going to be the Last Supper here. So I said on the way out, I said, Holy Father, if you don't bury me, I want you to know that I'll finish when I started. In terms of your biography. And, you know, that's a promise I intended to keep and, you know, have kept, and it'll be up, as you know, in September. But I have to say, I came home and I said to my colleagues at 30 Rockefeller's Plaza, you know, this could go on for a while. I mean, there's nothing organically wrong with this guy. But I was talking to my brother, who's a very good doctor and does a lot of geriatric medicine, about this at Christmas, at dinner. And he said, you know, what'll get him is he'll catch a cold or the flu, and then stuff will freeze up, and that'll be it, which is, of course, what happened 6 weeks later. I should mention in that regard that 6 weeks before, my father died October 19th, 2004, so almost 2 months before this day. And my wife had stayed up in Baltimore with my mother at my parents' house to help her get ready for the funeral. And after the wake, I had gone back to Bethesda. And I had poured a very stiff shot of bourbon. And suddenly, click, 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 a fax from the Pope to be read at the funeral. And the first thing he asked me at dinner 2 months later was, "How's your mother?" That pastor's instinct. So yeah, that was interesting to be able to read that in the Cathedral of Baltimore. Yes,
George, can you talk a little bit about his priestly work ethic? I mean, one of the things that's always struck me, even in his 80s, he was putting in full days. And at the same time, despite an incredible output, meeting with almost everybody. I mean, I admire Pope Benedict very much in basically saying, I've got to make a choice between being able to produce and keep the schedule. JP, he sacrificed a little bit of that, as I think 99% of human beings would. JP, too, until the end, always made himself incredibly accessible at the same time that he worked. And I'm trying to sort of learn what's imitable there from my own priestly work. So,
He would often say, "We have all eternity to rest." So, I mean, there was this sense of, you know, you sort of keep it in overdrive as long as you can. But he was also sensible about vacation. You know, he had said at the beginning of the pontificate, if I don't get 300 hours of exercise a year, I start getting nervous, you know, physically antsy and whatnot. So until the body betrayed him, I mean, he really took vacations, he got real exercise. These now legendary sneaking out to go skiing, that was not just, you know, saying to the usual way of doing things. That was all important for him. And he took real vacations during the summer. I mean, there was no, aside from the absolutely essential stuff that nobody can get away from. I mean, he would take books with him, the stuff he wanted to read during the year. And he would pace himself during the week. I mean, they tried to keep, it varied, Tuesdays or Wednesdays, reasonably free of the official stuff. Now, I think the other thing about the difference between these two personalities is that Wojtyla learned from people. I mean, he never read newspapers. In part because the newspapers that were in the Poland of his, you know, priesthood and episcopacy were crap. I mean, aside from the one Catholic paper that was any good. I tried to tell him he really wasn't that much different from the junk we get today. different brand of crap. He would barely glance at this daily news brief they do. He learned from people. And so that constant parade of people through the apartment for mass, for lunch, for dinner, was how he learned and how he satisfied what for me was perhaps his most striking psychological characteristic. And that was this relentless curiosity. I mean, I have just never met anybody who always wanted to know what was going on. Quite to this, and by what's going on, I mean everything from, you know, books, movies, who's up, who's down, politics, families, kids' lives. I mean, relentless curiosity, but driven by this sense that every one of these lives he encountered was a life that was caught up in this cosmic drama of creation, redemption, and sanctification. But he really did insist on time off. Excuse me. And, you know, in Jewish, he had a guy who knew how to make his life work the way he wanted it to work. He was also a very disciplined reader of stuff. I mean, he had gotten used to, when he became a bishop and had to leave the regular teaching schedule at Lublin, his graduate students used to read and brief books for him. And they would do summaries, and then they'd flag whatever the Polish post-it notes of the 1960s were. You know, flag passages they thought he could read. He should read himself. Excuse me. And pollen is doing a job here. So that's how he kept up with his professional intellectual life. Now, not everybody has people who can do that for them. I've just begun to start learning to do that for myself. I've always had really been lucky with the kids who work for me, but I have an exceptionally fine young man working for me now. And he can give me, if I want, one page, 2 pages, 5 pages, 10 pages, and then he'll give it to me. You know, we do it that way. And then he'll flag stuff that he thinks I ought to specifically look at. So I think it was that sort of business. Does that answer?
It does, essentially. I have always been impressed. One, and everybody's literally said this about him. When you meet him, you're the only person that says, at the same time, his mind's comprehending everything. And those, for me, are kind of opposing forces, where for him, they were in harmony. And so I've always just been amazed.
Yeah, as a human personality, there were a lot of things that don't normally go together that go together. I mean, mystic and jock are not two things that usually... Didn't seem to be a lot of mysticism out on that court in Lucas Oil Stadium last month. A few elbows. But that went together in him. I guess, Roger, the other thing I would have to say, and I say this because I think it's true, not because it's a pleasant piety, his prayer was an enormous source of energy. And it wasn't just the hour or 90 minutes of private prayer before the Mass at 7:30. It was, when he would be walking from one meeting to another in the Vatican, he wasn't, talking about, what's going on in the Italian Premier League here. And he was saying a couple of decades of the Rosary or something like that. And then if you were ever close to a papal mass, at least beforehand, I mean, he would really kind of withdraw into himself for the 10 or 15 minutes before the mass and, get whatever he got, centered, I suppose, is the phrase. And that was very much part of, I think, the energy of his life. He was energized by his... Yes.
There are some times when you can understand if a situation is pivotal or a person is pivotal. For example, Washington, his contemporaries knew that he was pivotal. So I'm wondering, regarding the Holy Father, John Paul II, assuming he had very little, false modesty, false humility, did he understand, do you think, sufficiently how pivotal his papacy was?
Well, I think he knew from an early age that he was a person of certain singular gifts, intellectually in particular. He grew into this mystical side of his personality over time. And that had, as all such things in the Carmelite iteration of it, ups and downs. I mean, in this new book, I describe the summer of 2003, and really up to his Silver Jubilee celebration, as a real dark nightmare, as I think it really was. In part because they couldn't fix the knees, and he was really in a terrible amount of pain. In part because the summer of 2003 was just unspeakable. hardly on. And I think he was really wrestling with this, what are you doing to me here? And that all of this ran up, and then of course his sadness over the war in Iraq, which he was obviously unhappy about, etc. And I think all of that weighed on him. I remember very well the right before the actual 25th anniversary, the Polish version of PBS was going to do a 2.5-hour tribute to John Paul II. It was going to be anchored in Rome in the Sala Clementina of the Apostolic Palace. And there were going to be 4 live sites around Poland, Warsaw, Krakow, Częstochowa, and Wadowice, I guess. And about a month before this, you ended up pinch hitting for me because of this. I was supposed to be talking to some marriage encounter thing or engaged encounter, and I get a fax from the producer of this show in Warsaw, saying, we're doing this, and we would like you to be one of the people at the anchor site in Rome. Well, you get a million of these things. And so I sent it over to Jamish, and I said, is this serious? And, or not, and you want me to do it? And I, got back the euphemism, it would be appreciated if you would do this, which was Stanislav speak for get your ass over here. So I called Roger, who pinch hit for me in Harrisburg.
Roger, you didn't ask you to go to Rome.
So I'm there for this thing. And there are 5 talking heads, Rocco Buttiglione and me, and then Sodano, Etchegaray, and Silvestrini, a most improbable triad. And anyway, so we were told, you're not going to see the Pope. Pope's up in the apartment. They've got a special live feed up there, but, he's not coming down. Well, it was this Polish youth choir singing to entertain. It was diplomatic corps and bigwigs from the Vatican and whatnot. Curious. And if you know the layout of the building, the Sala Clementina's upper windows are the windows of the chapel of the papal apartment. And the windows were open, and he had heard these kids sing. And he wanted to come down and say hi to the kids. So to everybody's total astonishment, 15 minutes before we go live, they wheel him in the back. And he goes, and all the kids come up, and then he indicates he wants to talk to them. These people up here. Well, I am, by an order of magnitude, the junior subaltern in this army. So I put myself at the end of the line, and I almost lost it when I got to the back. His face was completely frozen. He couldn't even say thank you, dziękuję, grazie, whatever. And the eyes were, were just trying to tell me, see what's happened to me. To the point where I almost lost it walking back up to the front. And I said, you got to get a grip here, buddy, because we're getting close to showtime. That was a dark night experience for him, that whole period. And then he had bounced back. I mean, that's mid-October. I was back 2 months later for the annual pre-Christmas dinner, and he was full of beans and, very good humor and all the rest. So I think it was, he was not immune to the up and down of all of that.
But did he know how pivotal his papacy was? Did he understand he was doing a great thing for the church?
Yeah, I think so, in the sense that, for example, I said to him in October of 2000, still had 2 months to go in the Jubilee year, has the Jubilee met your expectations? because as I explain in the new book, he was the only guy who believed in this. I mean, the view was he's really lost his mind. You know, in 1994, when he called all the cardinals together to talk about, you know, this thing's coming in 6 years, what do we do? So they talk about Rwanda and something or else and leave, and he's got to do the whole deal. So he does it. And I think he was very aware that that was, you know, the focal point of the whole thing. And so when I asked him in October 2000, has this met your expectations? He said it's exceeded my expectations. I never expected this would be so, the response to this would be so great. So I think he had a sense of having wrestled this huge institution around in the direction that he thought the council had intended it to go. But no one was more aware than he was of all the difficulties in doing that. I think that's why 2002 hit him very hard. I think that's why the continuing lack of excitement in the world episcopate about this whole idea of Duke and Elton was a constant aggravation. But on the, you know, on the 1989 stuff, I think he was more modest than he ought to have been. He said the tree was rotten. I just gave it a good few good shakes. But he never said to me, you know, you're wrong about that. I mean, I wasn't so crucial in this. And in fact, that the book I wrote about that, The Final Revolution, was the beginning of our serious conversation. And I think what he liked about that was not that I had made him the hero, but that I had made truth and culture the crucial instrument of change. I think that's how he thought of it in that sense. I mean, I don't know quite what more to say beyond that. Yes, ma'am.
Is the document you referred to on Vatican II, the preparatory document, is that available in
you? His contribution to that? I quote it pretty extensively in Witness to Hope. And it is in those volumes of the Anti-Preparatory Commission, the first volumes of the Acta of Vatican II, but I think the gist of it is in Witness to Hope, and there should be an endnote reference to the specific. I don't think that's online. I don't think the Acta of Vatican II are.
You were given photocopies.
No, I mean, I was just Xerox and stuff, but I, you know, they've got this whole new Vatican website with documents coming at your ears on it. It may be on there. It's really an interesting bunch of stuff in many, many respects. But don't miss the Archbishop of Boyle while you're at it. That's really cool. Yes, Mark.
Just a real short question. His opening 8 years that led up to the collapse of communism in 1989, did he consider his relationship with President Ronald Reagan a true friendship, or was it more of a geopolitical cooperation?
I think it was somewhere between the two. I mean, I remember him being very sad. When did Reagan die? 2003?
June 5th, 2004.
So this must have been Christmas, right before Christmas 2003. And I had just run into Ed Meese in Washington. And I said, how's President Reagan? And he said, George, it's sad beyond description. He said, I went out there for the christening of the USS Ronald Reagan. Mrs. Reagan had gone. He couldn't go. So Ed had brought him one of the baseball caps with, you know, USS Ronald Reagan or CB, whatever. And he took it to him. I guess he was still going into Los Angeles to an office once or twice a week. And Ed said, I gave it to him, and he said to me, thanks, Ed. That's very kind. Why would anyone want to name a ship after me? I mean, he had zero memory of being the president of the United States. So when I told that story to the Pope in December of 2003, he looked so sad and said to me, would you please find a way to extend my concern and prayers to Mrs. Reagan. So obviously I called Mies as soon as I got back and passed that along. They were an interesting pair. You have two men who were essentially orphans early. I mean, Wojtyla literally before he was 21. And Reagan more or less because the father had this horrible alcoholism. They were both men of the theater, men of drama, who believed that there was something more in the dramatic arts than just a skill set, as we say, that there was actually some insight into the human condition. They both had utterly unconventional career paths. They both were convinced, if in different ways, that truth has its own power if you articulate it clearly enough. And I think what sealed the deal was that they both survived assassination attempts within 2 months of each other. Because Hinckley was in like late March 81 and Adjo was May 13th, 81. And there is a fairly extensive correspondence from the first years of the pontificate that's about vocation. And Reagan writing the Pope about his sense of having been spared for some great purpose, and particularly to solve the problem of nuclear weapons. And I think for his part, Reagan was just enamored of JP too, as was George Bush II, who once said to me that the funeral of John Paul II was one of the three most important days of his life. Pretty good. But Reagan had, Dick Allen talks about this a lot, that Reagan had watched the 9 days of June 79 and had really been terribly impressed by so as soon as he got in, he told the intelligence community that we're sharing everything that we've got, including sources, with the Pope. So there was a lot of stuff back and forth that way. Now, whether the Pope actually learned anything from that he didn't know already, I tend to doubt, because he probably had a better intel operation than we did. Not hard to imagine that. And from the other side, Reagan was, John Paul II's acid test for politicians was, is this man prepared to lose power for what he believes to be the truth? Or is he just driven by power and position and whatnot? That's why he liked Gorbachev. I mean, it's one of the few judgments of... I don't think he was wrong about Gorbachev's character. But Gorbachev, to me, was, and probably still is in some respects, a reform communist. I mean, he was never really prepared to confront the fact that the whole thing was no good from the get-go. But the Pope was less interested in that than in the fact that he sensed in this guy a guy who was willing to put his power and in some respects his neck on the line for what he believed to be true. And I think he sensed that in Reagan too. And of course there was a lot of, you know, commonality of interest, not only in Central and Eastern Europe, but on the life issue questions and all that stuff. So, but were they friends? I mean, that would probably be pushing it too hard. But I mean, I think the deep mutual respect. And I also think an understanding on both sides that I don't need to get in the other guy's lane here. You know, these are parallel lanes, and the highway is going in the same direction, but I should stick in my lane, and I'm not going to mess with the other guy's lane. And that was, I think that was very useful and very mature, on, you know, on both sides of that. Yeah. Yes, one more. Yeah. Well, as I said this afternoon, I think he had this. Well, let me back this up. Historic relations between Latin Rite Polish clergy, Greek Catholics, and Orthodox are not, shall we say, historically characterized by fraternal bonhomie. I mean, it's usually, you know, been pretty nasty stuff. Wojtyla was utterly different. He had an enormous respect for the Greek Catholic Church of Ukraine. And he had read seriously in the modern Orthodox theologians, particularly Soloviev. I've long said somebody's got to write a dissertation on Wojtyla and Soloviev, because I think there's some very, very interesting and suggestive parallel intuitions there. And I think he got from Soloviev, or at least Soloviev confirmed in him, his personal intuition that the crisis of Christendom, if you will, had something to do with this fracture between East and West, and that putting that back together was essential to the human project. In the new book, in the evaluative section, I suggest that his intuition and his hope may not have sufficiently conjured with some very real problems in the Orthodox world. One is, of course, you know, it's the parallel to when people talk about Europe. And Henry Kissinger always says, when I want to call Europe, what number do I call? I mean, who do I call to get Europe? Well, it's like, who do I call to get Orthodoxy? I mean, you don't just call Constantinople, because that'll get all sorts of other people to act on. So that divisiveness. The utterly despicable way in which Russian Orthodoxy treated him for 25 years. I mean, really despicable. Alexei, former KGB guy, Pimen, former KGB guy. I mean, these were really bad people in many respects. And they were just not going to have this Polak, you know, on their territory, as they thought of him. I mean, it's a real, real antipathy there. Beyond that kind of tawdry human crumminess, 1054 was not an isolated moment. And I think he tended to think of it that way. 1054 was, in fact, the cash out of a process that had been arguably underway since, what, the Second Council of Constantinople, or the Second Council of Nicaea. It was coming apart for linguistic reasons, theological reasons, philosophical reasons. And the offer in Ut Unum Sint, which I have always taken with respect to Orthodoxy to be, why can't we go back to the status quo ante the exchange of excommunications and live that way? But that's not an isolated moment, and it wasn't a particularly pretty picture 3 weeks before the exchange of excommunications. So there's that point. Then the degree to which, over 900 plus years, the idea, I am not in communion with the Bishop of Rome, has for many Orthodox Christians become an essential part of their self-understanding in a way that's utterly incomprehensible to us. I mean, none of us, I suspect, for a moment in our lives, has ever said, the fact that I am not in full communion with the Ecumenical Patriarchate of Constantinople is part of who I am. it just doesn't occur to us. I mean, this is just not part of who we are. But it is part of who they are. And then you find this in its most grotesque form in the Athenite monks, on Mount Athos, and all the hell they raised about the Pope coming to Holy Greece and all this. In a less gross but still pretty bad form, the high identification of ethnicity and orthodoxy in Russia, Greece, some other places. These are all very, very serious problems. And I'm not sure he had measured the full degree of that. I think he thought by bending over backwards, by letting the blows fall on him, he could demonstrate a different possibility. Now, it should have been pretty clear by the mid-90s that this wasn't going to happen. So, what did he do? He begins working around the periphery of the Orthodox world, Bulgaria, Romania, finally gets the Greeks to allow him in, but only by using government as a lever in 2000. But at the end, they would not let him bring the Kazanskaya back to Russia. I mean, he had to send Casper with the thing. That is a great story, by the way. You all know this fantastic icon. It's one of the four great iconic models in Russian iconography. And it's in a jeweled, crowned, gold, silver, pearls, whatever, case that is unbelievable. The whole thing's only about so I had seen this out at Castel Gandolfo the night I gave him Witness to Hope, and where we went out to the chapel, and where Javish had taken the photographic plates from Arturo Mari, and Bono, or whatever his name is, Irish singing goes. Had been out there earlier in the day, and he's kneeling down in front of the Pope, and the Pope pulls the sunglasses off and puts them on himself. Arturo's there snapping away, and said, "I'll take that."
Photos got out anyway.
Then later they did. So anyway, I see this thing, and it's explained to me what this is. And then on January 2nd, I'm up there for lunch with my wife, Mike Novak, and his wife, Richard Newhouse, and a Polish Dominican colleague of theirs. And I'm down at the end of the table near Stanislaw, who leans over to me at one point and says, "Do you think the ladies would like to see the icon?" And I said, "Well, I think everybody wants to see the icon." So he goes out to the chapel and brings this thing in and says, "Explain it." I said, "Stasio, if I explain it, they're all going to panic. Let's just pass it around, leave it in Mari." So we're this utterly priceless thing that you could not buy an insurance policy is being passed around like a box of Godiva chocolate around the Pope's dinner table, while the Pope, who's having a great time, is pointing at the Goodyear blimp outside and said, "See, Juan Ano." Then when I told everybody, I told nobody else what the hell this thing was. And I told them this as we're walking down, and they almost fainted. Like, "Well, God, I can't dare touch this thing." I said, "That's why I told you I wasn't going to tell you what it was when we were in there." But he really wanted to express his regard for the Christian spirituality embodied in that artifact by bringing it back, and of course they wouldn't let it. So we sent Casper and the Friendly Ghost back, and whatever.
Time for one more?
Yeah. Yes, Father.
Do you think chance of Rapprochement?
I think we're going to talk about this a little bit tomorrow when I talk about Benedict and Islam. I think what might begin to change things on, well, there's a couple of things. On the Russian side, the fact that he's not a Pole makes a difference. So why the hell the Russians would like a German is an aspect of the Russian mind that I don't pretend to understand here. You know, it's like the Poles, when I was there last summer, and there was... Germans came in on September 1st, Russians came in on September 17th. Putin had announced that he was coming to the September 1st commemoration up in Westerplatte near Gdańsk, to which all of my mordant humor Polish friends said, what the hell is he doing that? It's 16 days too early. Anyway, the fact that he's not, for some odd reason, this may... And I would not be surprised if something happened. This is all depending on Putin's calculation of his own political interests. In the long haul of, the medium haul of history, the fact that Orthodoxy is becoming increasingly a set of islands in a roiling Islamic sea may... start shifting some heads about the fact that there is this lifeline to the world's attention called the Holy See, and maybe we better, start getting reconnected. Now, I put that in a column once, and I got letters from the Archie Mandrake of this, Assistant Bishop. We'd rather die before doing that.
The difference between Alexei and Kirill is also going to be, I think, a tremendous
factor. It is, although, he's a less hard-edged character, but you don't get to Geneva at age 26 without being on the team back in those days. So, Kirill at least has a KGB background. Now, I've met him on three different occasions, very smooth, very seemingly committed ecumenically. But I think it's going to be this Islamic surround of various large parts of the Orthodox world. The other thing that might be interesting is it's entirely possible that given these draconian rules that the Turkish government imposes on the ecumenical patriarchy, that Bartholomew is the last ecumenical patriarch of Constantinople in Istanbul for a while. They may just not have a character who fits, it has to be a Turkish-born citizen of Greek origin who's acceptable. This is a narrow, narrow field. So what happens if they don't have anybody 30 years from now, or 20 years from now, and they say, the hell with the Turks, we've got to temporarily move this someplace else. Well, suppose they get hospitality from the Bishop of Rome. There are all sorts of curious possibilities. But the enthronement, this whole notion of Turkey and Europe, until they stop trying to run the Orthodox Church. What's that? Mm-hmm. Very, very bad. I don't know that Benedict has the feel for the Eastern Catholic Churches that J.P. 2 had. He may. What's your sense of that, Mike?
Well,
it's hard to say. I know I can see it going both ways, because we had a lot of people in our church who were a little bit suspect of John Paul II for a couple of incidents. I don't place a lot of stock in, but there was some, and I haven't seen anything like that from Benedict, so the jury is still out.
Well, interesting stuff. Okay, what's the plan now?
Thanks, everybody. Mm,
thank you all
very,
very much.
If anybody who's hungry would like a snack, there'll be a snack down outside the refectory where we were. At 9:30, we'll be having night prayer downstairs, which is about an hour. If you're tired after the whole trip and everything else and want to grab, feel free to do night prayer on your own. We'll be doing it downstairs in the chapel at 9:30. And then if you haven't picked up a schedule downstairs, please do pick one up tomorrow morning. We begin at 7:30 in the chapel. Okay. Thanks.
Good.